From New York to California, Iowa to North Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, several Republican presidential candidates want to abolish the U.S. Department of Education. Is that a good idea? We find out from Jonathan Butcher of the Heritage Foundation. Congress will soon return from its August recess, and the battle over the federal budget, due October 1st, will take center stage. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Nikki Haley distinguished herself during the Republican presidential debate by taking on both parties over spending and the national debt. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And can Donald Trump win the 2024 presidential election, or has his support hit a ceiling short of that goal? Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The U.S. Department of Education was in the crosshairs at the recent Republican presidential debate. Abolishing that cabinet agency has long been a GOP goal. To learn more, we turn to Jonathan Butcher. Jonathan is a senior research fellow in education policy at the Heritage Foundation. Jonathan, welcome to American Radio Journal. Jonathan, when we talk about the United States Department of Education, tell us, what does an education department do at the federal level?
The Department of Education, as we know it today, hasn't always been around. The first Department of Education at the federal level was created in the mid-19th century, but it didn't last very long. And it wasn't until the mid-20th century that the responsibilities of Washington, when it came to what is really a local issue, and that's education, began to increase. And that was really around Lyndon Johnson's presidency. So fast forward to 1980, and that's where teacher unions ultimately convinced the Carter administration to make it a cabinet-level agency. Since that time, they've spent the last 40-plus years basically funneling money from the federal treasury to local school districts, sometimes to individual schools, but largely they go to state departments of education. It's important for people to realize that Washington actually funds about 40% of the salary money for employees at state departments of education. So at your state capital, they're doing a lot of work that Washington has created for them, and that Washington, in turn, pays them to do.
This all sounds a lot like busy work, make work type of situation here. As you pointed out, education is predominantly at the local level. I know I live in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We have local school boards. We have 500 school districts. We, of course, have the State Department of Education. So is it really appropriate, from your point of view, for the federal government to be engaged in this type of activity?
No. I mean, there is not a constitutional authority for Washington to have a cabinet-level agency that does all of the various things that the Department of Education does. I think perhaps even more urgent or equally as urgent as fundamental rights is this question of, has it done any good? And over the past 40 years in particular, as you've looked at student test scores and the amount of money that goes from federal taxpayers to the Department of Education and then on to districts, it has been an utter failure. I mean, student test scores today in math and reading are back to where they were in the 1990s. Students have made no measurable improvement in the major subjects. And in longitudinal studies, okay, of student scores, 17-year-olds are and have scored at about the same level for decades. So what that means is that if you have a student, let's say they make some improvement in fourth grade, which, by the way, they are not today, but for a period of time in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was some movement. But then they get to eighth grade, then they get to graduate, and then again to high school. They're scoring the same place that students were many years ago. So we're not moving the needle here, nor are we closing achievement gaps. There's also been research showing that the gap between students at the upper end of the income scale and those at the lower end, that gap has persisted and is about the same size that it's been since even the 1950s with the best numbers we have. So I think that what we've created in Washington is not helping parents choose quality options for their children.
A number of the candidates who were participating in the Republican presidential debate here a couple of weeks ago, Jonathan, suggested that they would abolish the Department of Education. Is that something that could reasonably be accomplished?
It absolutely could. I think that in our work at the Heritage Foundation, we have outlined how responsibilities can be shifted to other agencies better suited for those tasks. And then other responsibilities just need to be sunset entirely. So look at the Office of Civil Rights in the Department of Education. Those responsibilities can be moved to the Department of Justice, and anything that is duplicative, of which there's probably some, can be eliminated. And then for the National Center of Education Statistics, which keeps track of student test scores and data on everything from attendance to spending and more, that could be moved to the Census Bureau, which already does plenty of data tracking on its own. And then responsibilities like student loan programs, those should be largely eliminated. I mean, for Washington to be the default lender for some 90% of student loans is, it's frankly shocking, right? I mean, this is not what Washington should be doing. And we have upwards of 1.7, getting on 2 trillion in outstanding student loans right now. And Washington, of course, has taken its sweet time in getting back to having people pay these loans. And meanwhile, taxpayers are paying something like $5 billion a month in interest alone to cover this delay. So, you know, there are various things that can be eliminated, and then there are other things that can be shifted to other agencies.
Going back at least as far as Ronald Reagan, it has been almost consistently part of the Republican platform to eliminate the Department of Education. As you look around the country now and we see educational freedom, school choice gaining steam, do you think that perhaps with the right mix of president and party control of Congress that this is something that might become politically achievable?
I do, and I also think that the pandemic showed parents what really goes on in the public system. Not only did they see more about what their children were learning in the classroom because they were observing what online courses and instruction and all of those kinds of things, but also I think parents recognized that at the moment they needed help, at the moment they needed a school system and a federal agency to help them care for their children by continuing their education during a very troubling and difficult time, they failed, right? The agency failed. It failed to keep schools open. The traditional assigned schools failed. They stayed closed for way too long, and we know that by the decrease in student test scores and, frankly, by the tens of thousands of students that districts can't even find today. The rates of student absences and even teacher absences are striking right now. So at a moment when we needed a government agency to perform at a very high level, it didn't. And so I think that parents can be convinced by saying, hey, look, you deserve to have the authority of how and where your children learn, and states need to be able to choose how to create more options for families, and it shouldn't be something that Washington has any say over.
I suppose were we to eliminate the bureaucratic structure of the Department of Education, Jonathan, there would be a substantial cost savings that could be directed either elsewhere to education or to other needs. Has anybody been able to quantify what that savings might be?
We have. In our report, we go through what those cost savings would be for each part of the agency. So all of this is spelled out in our paper on heritage.org.
And so we are talking with Jonathan Butcher, who is a senior research fellow in education policy at the Heritage Foundation. You gave us the website, Jonathan. Tell us a bit about Heritage.
Sure. The Heritage Foundation is the world's largest conservative think tank, headquartered in Washington, D.C. We are committed to helping to preserve America where freedom, opportunity, prosperity, and civil society flourish. And we cover issues across the board with domestic policy as well as foreign policy.
Heritage.org is the website. We have been talking with Jonathan Butcher, Senior Research Fellow in Education Policy at Heritage. Jonathan, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Congress has not been in session. They are on their August recess, but looking to return here in a little over a week. The budget is a big deal, due by October 1st, so we're going to talk about that with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
The Club for Growth, along with a number of other conservative organizations, are staking their position in this budget battle that's going to be front and center here over the next few weeks. Want to tell us what's going on there?
We know that at the end of September, there's another one of these funding deadlines in Washington. And stop me if you've heard this before, but Congress needs to pass annual appropriation bills to keep the federal government funded, or else you have what's known as a federal government shutdown. And in this instance, Congress has not done its work on appropriations. The Senate has passed zero bills. The House has only passed one bill so far, and nothing has been signed into law. So we know that there's been a little bit of a backroom negotiation between Chuck Schumer and Speaker Kevin McCarthy on what to do about that. And what they're planning on doing is passing a continuing resolution, which would fund government at current levels for a short period of time. The problem with that is that it continues to back Congress up to kick the can down the road and push us toward crisis legislating around the holidays. So this week, leaders at many, many conservative organizations, over 100 conservatives, signed this letter calling on Congress to pass an appropriations bill that returns federal spending to the levels that we were spending at prior to COVID. And it also says that we need to address our border crisis. And then you also have Congress trying to figure out what they're going to do with Ukraine spending and what they're going to do with disaster relief spending following the hurricane on the East Coast, as well as the tragic fire in Hawaii. And so there's this pot of money called the Disaster Relief Fund. The House of Representatives wants to add about $12 billion to that, and they want to give $24 billion to Ukraine. We think, as conservative organizations, that Congress needs to stop this emergency supplemental appropriation spending and instead follow regular order and make sure that it fits within the current budget constraints that we have enacted into law.
I understand that one of the goals of the House Freedom Caucus here, Scott, is that these spending bills, I guess there are, what, a dozen of them altogether, appropriations bills, the House Freedom Caucus wants to do them one by one rather than roll them into one giant omnibus bill that we try to pass on Christmas Eve as usual.
Yeah, I think that some of the Freedom Caucus members would be okay to maybe load up two together at once. But when you have all 12 together, it creates political pressures that accommodate the passage of big government. And that's what's continued to happen over the last two decades in Washington. We know that the radical left is going to say, and the media is going to say, well, if there's a government shutdown, we're not funding our national security and our national defense. Well, what Republicans in the House are saying is, let's pass the Defense Department appropriations legislation now so that the Defense Department doesn't shut down at the end of September. Let's get that bill signed into law. But of course, Chuck Schumer doesn't want to do that because he knows that the defense bill brings Republican votes for a larger package in the Senate. And when you have a weaponized and politicized appropriations process that isn't just checking the boxes and making sure that we have good government funded, but instead is used to fund ideology and a progressive wish list that the left has, then I think that people start to lose trust in the system. I think that the process breaks down, and that's ultimately when you get a federal government shutdown.
And Scott, as we look to all of these budget talks and budget negotiations, some concern has arisen, particularly over the health of Senator Mitch McConnell, who is the Republican leader in the Senate. He's had yet another episode. How do you see that really impacting things?
That's a great question. Usually you have what's known as a four-corner agreement when you have the Speaker of the House, and then you have the Minority Leader, and then you have the Majority and Minority Leaders of the United States Senate, the four of them coming together and doing a negotiation. The leader of the Republican Senate is still Mitch McConnell. He's obviously had a couple of public health episodes, senior moments, call them what you will, but it's been demonstrated to the American people that he has lost his train of thought at least a couple of times during these press conferences, Nobody knows what's happening behind closed doors, but it weakens the United States Senate Republicans' ability to be engaged in these negotiations. And so there are probably other senators that are stepping up and helping Leader McConnell in those negotiations. I imagine the Republican whip, John Thune, would be right at the top of that list in terms of who's participating. But it also starts to spread the power away from the consolidation of power where it currently stands, and more so to the rank and file, giving everybody the ability to be a part of the legislative process. That is a good thing, right? We do want more people, more voices, more states' interests to be protected in the federal government, and getting away from really sort of the D.C. operation that I think has broken Washington.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit more about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. Our members are united in this idea of economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. If anybody wants to join the 500,000 members of Club for Growth, you can do so by signing up at clubforgrowth.org. And we also encourage you to check us out on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you, Loman.
Both Democrats and Republicans are responsible for the skyrocketing national debt. That charge was leveled by Nikki Haley during the first Republican presidential debate. For details, we turn to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
It's not quite true that of all the candidates on the stage for the first Republican primary debate last week, that I thought the person we'd be talking the least about this week was South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. That's not quite true. There were a couple of people on that stage that I thought would have a less significant, less impactful debate than she would. But she wasn't near the top of my list. She wasn't someone that I tuned in to hear what she had to say. But you know what? I came away from that first debate held last Wednesday in Wisconsin with the impression that she had maybe had the best performance of all, or at the very least that she had given me the one moment that I will remember from this debate, which happened way too early to really do much of anything in terms of deciding who's going to win the nomination. And that moment from Nikki Haley is what we're going to talk about today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. When it comes to runaway federal spending, unsustainable levels of borrowing, and the inflation that those first two things have helped unleash, I thought former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley made a great point Wednesday by saying that Republicans really need to look in the mirror when it comes to all of that. Not to say that it's not Biden's fault, too. Some of it is, certainly. But there's a good chunk of that debt. There's a good chunk of the deficit spending that Republicans have to face up to the fact that they're responsible for. This specifically is what she said early in the debate. It was one of her first responses, and I think it really set the tone for her strong performance throughout the evening.
That no one is telling the American people the truth. The truth is that Biden didn't do this to us. Our Republicans did this to us, too. When they passed that $2.2 trillion COVID stimulus bill.
And then this, I think, really the hammer blow to the whole thing.
They need to stop the spending. They need to stop the borrowing. They need to eliminate the earmarks that the Republicans brought back in. And they need to make sure they understand these are taxpayer dollars. It's not their dollars. And while they're all saying this, you have Ron DeSantis, you've got Tim Scott, you've got Mike Pence. They all voted to raise the debt. And Donald Trump added $8 trillion to our debt. And our kids are never going to forgive us for this.
She nailed it, folks. She absolutely nailed it. Republicans have to face up to this fact, and it's easy for them right now to be playing the fiscal conservative card because there's a Democratic president in office, there's Democrats in control of the Senate, and so Republicans, of course, retreat back to fiscal conservatism, fiscal restraint, fiscal responsibility when those things are true. But the last time that Republicans had unified control of government, what happened? President Donald Trump, who was in the White House the last time Republicans had full control of the federal government, promised somewhat hilariously during the 2016 campaign that he would pay off the national debt within 8 years. I mean, that was never going to happen. But at least I had some hope at the time. Okay, you know, he's going to do something about this. He's going to reduce the deficit. He's going to try to address the debt. When he got to the White House, when Trump checked in January of 2017, the national debt was just about $20 trillion, just under $20 trillion, hovering right around that point. He didn't pay off the national debt. Instead, federal spending actually climbed each of the first 3 years that Trump was in office, from about $3.9 trillion in fiscal year 2017 to $4.45 trillion in 2019. Those first 3 years, of course, all coming before the pandemic. Everything spending just went out of control. All of the emergency COVID spending that happened in 2020 spilling over into 2021, the first year of President Joe Biden's term. So it's hard to really take those 2 years seriously. But the 3 years before that, Trump and Republicans oversaw a significant increase in the federal baseline of spending. And when Trump left office, remember, when he came into office, the national debt was about $20 trillion. When he left office, it was nearly $28 trillion. Trump added $8 trillion, just about, to the national debt. And of course, Biden has just continued piling it on. Today, the national debt is at $32.7 trillion. And with the rate that it's going, by the time you hear this, we might be approaching $33 trillion, because that's how fast the numbers are piling up at this point. Now, look, as I said at the top, this first debate happened so early in the process. I mean, we are actually so far out from the first votes being cast in the Republican nominating process, the Iowa caucuses. Those will happen in mid-January. This debate happening in the middle of August, it's literally the equivalent of decorating for Christmas on the 4th of July. That's how far out we are from the first votes being cast. And Iowa, of course, is not going to decide who wins the nomination. So we're even further out from anything that's dispositive, any sort of actual decision point here for Republican voters, for most Republican voters. And so this first debate, I don't think it means much of anything. And I don't really like the punditry and the horse race stuff. So I'm not going to spend much time here talking about what this means for Haley's chances. But I will say this. She's a successful governor of a conservative state. She served in the Trump administration, but also kind of personally distanced herself from Donald Trump. So she's walked that tightrope. And unlike other candidates on the stage, too, she's kind of shied away from some of the culture war issues that I think have been too much of a distraction for conservatives the past few years. I'll also say this. I'm a libertarian. I write for Reason Magazine. And Nikki Haley and I are never going to see eye to eye on just about anything when it comes to foreign policy. So do not mistake anything that I'm saying today for an endorsement. But I think what she demonstrated in this first debate is a reason for her to stay in the race a little bit longer, and for Republican voters in general to give her, if not a long look, at least a second glance. Because Haley's decision to shine a spotlight on the bipartisan role that borrowing and spending in recent years has, the ways in which that has driven up the national debt and driven up the long-term consequences of that debt for all Americans, that was a welcome moment. And it was a powerful one for Haley, because she stood out during what was otherwise kind of a chaotic debate. And it's going to be critical for whoever wins next year's presidential election to be clear-eyed about the seriousness of the debt problem facing the federal government. And it's one that we need to talk more about. So kudos, Nikki Haley. Thanks for bringing it up in Wisconsin. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of last week's debate and everything else going on in politics as we hit the end of the summer here and really careen hard right into campaign season. All of that at Reason.com. And catch me again next week right here on American Radio Journal.
Support for Donald Trump in a general election appears to have hit a ceiling. But can he rise above it? Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
I don't often agree with John Fetterman, Pennsylvania's junior Democratic senator, but I found myself nodding vigorously at his recent assessment of Donald Trump's prospects in the state of Pennsylvania for November 2024. Now, I happen to be from Pennsylvania, and what Fetterman said of Trump in Pennsylvania, I could tell you, I think also applies nationwide. In a respectful, non-snarky, sober analysis, Senator Fetterman responded to a question from the New York Times about whether he believes the indictments against Trump will hurt him politically in Pennsylvania. Said Fetterman, quote, "It doesn't matter. I'm a senator, and I'm not sure how many times he's been indicted. He's been impeached twice. Has that changed anything? You're still seeing Trump signs everywhere in Pennsylvania. You have to respect his strength and all of that, unquote. You do indeed. Fetterman lives in Pennsylvania, as I do, and he, like me, sees the signs, just as we saw them in 2020, when there were far more signs. The number, in fact, in 2020 was incredible. I never saw anything like it. And yet, Donald Trump could not carry the Keystone State against Joe Biden. Still, adds Senator Fetterman, Trump remains competitive. Quote, Trump would be very competitive in Pennsylvania, but Trump has to perform above his ceiling. I think there's a hard ceiling in Pennsylvania he can't get past, unquote. Precisely, Senator Fetterman. And again, this applies not just to Pennsylvania for Trump, but nationwide. To be competitive is one thing, but to win is something else entirely. And the problem is indeed Donald Trump's political ceiling. As I've commented here before for American Radio Journal, Trump cannot get, in my opinion, 50% of the vote. The man is simply too hated. Trump supporters are excited right now about polls showing him leading or barely trailing Joe Biden. But look closer. Those polls once again expose Trump's limit, that ceiling. The current Real Clear Politics composite average shows Biden leading Trump 45.0 to 44.1%. Yes, that's a tight race, less than 1%. Trump supporters enthuse about the race being well within the margin of error. To that, I say, nonsense. Trump's overwhelming obstacle remains that he is more disliked than his disliked Democratic opponent. Like with his challenge of Hillary Clinton in 2016 and Biden in 2020, Trump in 2024 would face an unpopular Democrat. But his perennial problem is that he would always remain more unpopular than even these unpopular Democrats. Now, Trump advocates insist that he has been unfairly maligned and viciously persecuted and harassed more than any politician in American history. They want him to run again simply for the chance to stick it to the liberals and avenge their man. Here's their chance to enrage Democrats by electing him president. But what Donald Trump needs is not 10 million Americans who feel that way, but 70 million. Actually, probably 80 million. From November 2016 to November 2020, Donald Trump boomed his overall presidential vote total from 63 million to 74 million, a massive increase for an incumbent. And yet he still lost by 7 million. As Sleepy Joe somehow got 81 million votes, mainly because he wasn't Donald Trump. So look at the percentages. In 2016 against Hillary, Donald Trump got 46.1% of the vote. In 2020 against Biden, he got 46.8. Right now, he's polling at 44. That is not a winner, folks, not even against Sleepy Joe. Now, that said, Donald Trump could win in 2024 with that 46% ceiling if a third-party candidate entered the race and pulled votes from Biden, perhaps someone like RFK Jr. Will that happen? Well, we'll see. But that isn't something that Republicans should count on. My suggestion to Republicans, this isn't rocket science, folks. Nominate a candidate who can get 50% of the vote. And that means, in my opinion, someone other than Donald Trump. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KXRA-AM in Alexandria, Minnesota, KAYQ-FM in Warsaw, Missouri, along with WWOW-AM in Conneaut, Ohio. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.